Because of my love for you that I require this. I do love you, Hester, and I'm glad you are my wife. I just need to train you well in the ways of a devoted Amish housewife. I believe Kate was a bit loose with you. My mother always talked of it, wondering how the household would ever turn out with her lack of discipline. He gave her a sad look of righteousness, a sniff. I guess this latest episode answers my mother's concerns and questions. You ran away from home and lived English for a while. Noah has gone off to the war, I hear. They say Isaac got on a river barge with a man named Lee who worked on the river. Hester successfully hid any sign of caring or having heard. She acknowledged his words with a mere dipping of her head, a sipping of her tea. A fierce gladness welled up in her before she could quell it. Let Hans reap what he sowed. Let all his neglect come home to roost. He had never cared for those two boys, and now they apparently did not care for him. Why don't you answer me? William's voice was harsh. He leaned forward, his blue eyes intent, his mouth compressed into a slash of discipline. Oh, no, I mean, yes. I hadn't known about my brothers.
They are not your brothers. You have no ties to them.
No, I don't.
Did you know this riverman named Lee?
Rigid, with eyes downcast, Hester tried to decide quickly. If she shook her head, he would catch the lie, as sharp and perceptive as he was. If she said yes, he would see the past in her eyes.
Well?
Yes. He pulled us across the river a few times.
Is that all?
Yes. Miraculously, he believed her. Her hands shook as she held the cup, stirred the tea with a spoon.
I want Mother to teach you quilt making.
A sickening thud of her heart was followed by nausea roiling in her stomach, churning the food she had eaten. But I am not skilled with a needle.
Till the winter is over, you will have learned.
The thought of spending time with his mother, her hands clumsily plying the needle through fabric cut in exact squares and triangles, brought on a cold sweat, an acceleration of her heart. On the very next afternoon, Frances suddenly appeared in the kitchen like a dark ghost of discipline. Hester was sweeping the hearth and looked up to find her standing by the table. One eyebrow was elevated, one lowered.
Dishes not done yet?
Was her way of greeting. Yes, well, not all of them. I overbaked a cake, it's soaking.
What kind of cake?
A molasses, William's favorite.
He likes Gelbkuchen best.
He does?
Why, of course.
I'll make him one next time.
He wants me to teach you quilt making.
Gripping the back of a chair, Hester nodded. Out came the tumble of scraps. The scissors flashed in Frances's capable hands as she sliced expertly around the templates, cutting exact triangles and rectangles. Bits of fabric grew into tall stacks as her scissors raced along, keeping time to the staccato words from her thin mouth. So Hester had overstepped her bounds with Johnny. That's what happens when a woman has no children, like a cavorting heifer. William was so disappointed, very generous of him to forgive her for such a wrongdoing. She too could forgive. It was her duty. A Christian was called upon to do this. In time, she was sure that Hester would make a good wife. Hester acknowledged her words with a humble dip of her head. When she spoke, her eyes were clear, glistening with truth. I am not to blame for Johnny's overtures. He was drinking apple whiskey. I went down to the cellar, and he caught me about the waist. I struggled. When Frances met Hester's eyes, the truth in them found its mark, accurately piercing the false lies in her own. But expertly, in the same way she plied the scissors, she cut off the truth and flung it away with contempt.
Puh, they all say that. Every loose woman always comes up with an excuse.
Calmly, her eyes glowing, Hester spoke again, her voice clear, low, and husky, like bells enhancing her words. Then you must live with what you choose to believe. When Hester struggled to thread her needle, bending over the triangles she was laboriously bringing together, Frances noticed her long, uneven stitches. Patiently, she showed her how to shove only the tip of the needle into the fabric to make one tiny stitch, which immediately helped Hester improve. Frances soon noticed Hester's eye for color, the way she alternated the blue with the golden maize fabric and the red with the green, like a holly bush or a cardinal in a fir tree. But she was careful to withhold praise, careful to keep Hester from becoming Stoltz.
Words of praise would only serve to give her more free rein than she already had. Till the week's end, Hester had acquired a new level of quilt making. She endured Francis's words of rebuke and her criticism like an unwelcome cold. She dealt with her inability to please, stayed patient, and was rewarded with a perfect quilt top that contained a star pattern, its symmetry so pleasing that her eyes lit up with delight. Francis almost warmed to her beautiful daughter-in-law. William was happy beyond Hester's expectations. He praised her work and told her about the verses in Proverbs that lift up a woman who pleases her husband by the work of her hands, then takes her goods to market. She cooked his meals the way he liked them, stayed at home for the required weeks, went to church, and held little baby Abner. She whispered senseless bits of news and gossip with her friend Sarah, evading her questions about the tinctures and the herbs, saying in winter it was hard to find them. Amos was doing better, but could not stand to do a full day's work yet. Hester said the sun in spring would help. The snows came often, piling around the stone house and blowing across the Lancaster landscape in great white stinging clouds, whipped up by a relentless north wind that created drifts higher than a man's head. Horses floundered up to their bellies in packed snow. Sleds overturned, spilling loads of firewood into deep white drifts. The men shouted and shoveled through the snow, their faces red with cold and irritation, clapping their gloved hands down on the crowns of their black felt hats as the wind tugged at their wide brims. William came into the house for a scarf that he tied under his chin, tucking his beard beneath it as well. Hester laughed, thinking him very handsome without the long, bushy black beard, and told him so, blushing. He smiled at her, then held her securely in his arms, kissing her soundly before he went outside to join the shoveling crew. At times such as these, Hester believed she did love him. She did. Perhaps she expected too much from the word love. Obedience, having no will of her own, brought good times. Weren't her quilts a visual display of her obedience? Wasn't Francis's teaching a blessing? When the news of sick children reached her ears, a longing welled up in her so intense that she felt she had to go somehow. When a 4-year-old succumbed to lunga fever and a 10-year-old to seizures because of an escalated temperature caused by the same disease, she battled with her will to go nurse them, to be allowed to administer the herbs of her foreparents. She fiercely believed that the old Indians carried a wealth of information that they passed down from one generation to the next, and she knew many of these remedies. Miserable, she stood in the snowy graveyards, her black hat hiding her sorrow, her black shawl wrapped around her desperate longing to save these children. She cried with parents, remembering her mother Kate and her sister Rebecca. She listened to mothers, looking on helplessly as their children choked on swollen tonsils and thrashed feverishly on soiled beds, the doctor unable to save them. She baked pies and bread and took them to houses with William by her side. She bent to view yet another child, lying white and lifeless, its eyes closed, dressed in white, a life cut off before its time by the dreaded diseases of winter. One cold winter evening, when the stars hung like little individual icicles, the wind moaning around the eaves, the blowing snow whispering the sadness of the little children's deaths, Hester could bear it no longer. She laid aside the pattern of triangles she was sewing, gathering the ends to fold them into the ryegrass basket at her side, breathed in, and turned to her husband. William, must these children die? Astounded by her words, William raised his head from the German Bible he had been reading.
Why, Hester, I am surprised at your question. Have you not heard Bishop Joel say so clearly that their time was up? God needed these children in heaven. They are angels now.
His eyes were heavy-lidded with the patience he needed to exercise over his wife's childish question. Hester shivered and drew the corners of her light shawl around her neck. But if God put all these herbs on the earth for our use, then gives wisdom to people in how to use them, surely there is wasted knowledge somewhere.
The doctors did all they could.
The doctors don't know enough! Hester flung the words into the room with unbridled desperation and the repression that suffocated her spirit. Instantly, William was on his feet, towering over her with the strength of his anger.
Are you telling me, Hester, that you know more than the doctors? That thought is so preposterous, it's laughable.
No, I don't know more, just a better way.
You don't know anything.
William grated out his words like a rasp on an oak board. But I do, William. I want to help the sick children, just for the love of these suffering little ones.
Your Indian knowledge is witchcraft.
No, William, it is not. I believe that viper's grass made into a tea would help these little ones' lung fever.
William was breathing hard now, his eyes containing desperation. Here was his wife rising up again, displaying her own will, just when he thought that the winter months, tempered with the tutelage of his mother, had finally cured her of this nonsense. Viper's grass! You speak of your medicines in terms of serpents, even.
Ah, William, no! It is merely a grass. It grows in low places by the water, hence its name.
Frustrated, angered, and without a thought other than the contesting of his will and the need to stop it, he brought back his hand and administered a sharp crack to the side of her face. Hester's head snapped sideways. The shock in her eyes made William flinch, but only for a moment. He gathered his wits hurriedly and said she must never speak of these things again, ever, in his house. Hester's face stung, but she lowered her eyes. He gathered her limp form into his arms, whispering words of love, saying that if she rose up against him like a rebellious child, he would have to treat her as one. It was all done out of his great love for her. Never again did Hester contest her husband's will. That one blow finished any thoughts of changing his opinion about the herbal medicines and her ability to use them. She spent the remainder of that winter learning the art of quilt making. William praised her choice of colors. He built a small wooden frame for her, a clever device to hold portions of a quilt, so that she could stitch the piece top to the bottom layer of homespun fabric. Her needle flashed in the light of the oil lamp, her dark head bent to her work as she immersed herself in the skills her husband and his mother asked of her. Elias, her father-in-law, was a man of few words, a distant man who kept to himself, minding his own business. He was tall like Francis and spare, with the same loping gait as his sons. One evening, he asked Hester why she no longer made tinctures. Sam Riel had asked him the question in church. Flustered, Hester could not find words to fit the situation properly. William came to her aid immediately, however, telling his father that she had seen the error of her ways, recognized the pow-wowing of the Indians, and did not wish to continue. Slowly, then, Elias King cracked a chestnut with a nutcracker, popped a portion into his mouth, chewed, swallowed, and then met Hester's eyes. For only a second, a love like Kate's shone from his eyes, warm, soft, and so mellow and approving it was like a balm to a broken heart. He said evenly,
"Well, William, some of these old Indians know more than we do, and I personally don't think the devil has anything to do with it."
No one but Elias saw the look of warm gratitude Hester bestowed on him, and no one knew how Elias yearned to help his daughter-in-law, seeing how caught she was in the net of marriage covered by the deceit of piety. The same as he was. Chapter 15. When the snow began to melt in March of that year, the earth turned into a swamp of mud and water. The rains that poured from leaden skies caused the Conestoga and the Pequay to rise above their banks, the churning brown water spilling over them and spreading across the land. Monstrous swells ate up the dormant cornfields and licked greedily at fence posts, sagging gates, trees, and bushes. The angry waters carried away farm wagons and logs, sheds and chickens, bleeding sheep and terrified cows. It rolled buggies and carriages along, end over end, smashing them against stone foundations of bridges, treating them like matchsticks. The men were called to fill sandbags to keep the town of Lancaster safe. Elias and William rode horses through the fields, skirting flooded low-lying areas, answering the call for assistance. Francis and Hester were left alone to keep the animals fed and the cows milked. Normally, Hester did not milk cows. William said it was better for his parents and for him to continue doing the milking by themselves, that it was better for the cows to have familiar and experienced hands working with them. So now, when Hester dashed through the pouring rain, a kerchief tied around her head,
She looked forward to milking the cows. She had always milked at home in Berks County. Frances was beside herself with worry. She was terrified of floodwaters. So many people miscalculated and took risks, driving their buggies through waters that appeared to be shallow but were deceptively high, rolling them over and over after the churning waters caught the bottoms of the carriages. Hester shook the water off her head and shoulders, grabbed a wooden three-legged stool, and set to work, expertly pulling and squeezing the cow's teats. Thick streams of creamy milk poured into the bucket held firmly between her knees. Frances was amazed at Hester's ability. She did not allow one word of praise to escape her lips, but her eyes were approving. She asked Hester to spend the evening with her. She was afraid that her worry would undo her if she was alone. They walked back to the house along the sodden path, the rain pelting them with its fury. Hester looked up at the gray sky as if to calculate the duration of the rain, but had to admit that the heavens appeared the same as they had for 3 days. It was awkward, sitting in Frances's kitchen. Hester was required to call her mother, but had never felt any motherly love coming from her, ever. Only discipline and rebuking. Still, she was William's mother, so she made every effort to be respectful. She helped her set the table for the two of them. They ate slices of homemade bread with good yellow butter and ladled vegetable soup into big pewter bowls. Again and again, Frances's eyes appeared wild with terror. Repeatedly, she opened the door, peered out into the cold and the wind, and asked Hester when she thought the rain would stop. Hester told her the only bit of information she knew. If the wind continued from the northeast, there would be no change. That seemed to send Frances into despair. Hester, do you think the men will be safe?
Oh, I trust William to be careful. They are riding with a group of men. Surely they'll stick together and use sound judgment.
Frances nodded, but she became increasingly restless. She paced the kitchen. She added sticks of wood to the fire. She shivered when a gust of wind sent hard pellets of rain against the windowpane. She got down her Bible and began to read, her lips moving as she formed the words.
Hester, do you think the water will come up to the barn?
I wouldn't think so. We're up pretty high.
When Frances nodded, Hester was reminded of her stepmother Annie when her hands lost their strength, creating a vulnerability and a loss of power that was hard to watch. It was pitiful, in fact. Clearly, this rainstorm exposed a hidden weakness, a lack of faith in Frances.
Hester, don't go home to sleep.
Surprised, Hester looked at her. Where should I sleep?
Here.
Do you have a spare bed?
No, but... Oh, go then. I know you don't want to sleep in my bed with me.
I suppose I could.
No, you don't want to. Go home.
Quickly, Hester ran the short distance to her own door through the rain. She let herself in, poked up the fire, washed, and got into her long, warm nightgown. She crawled under the quilts and fell asleep to the rhythm of the rain on the shingled roof, tumbling down the steep incline from one hewn oak shingle to another, dripping onto the crumpled brown grass that had been covered with snowdrifts all winter long. She was awakened by a sobbing, wild-eyed apparition that struck terror to her heart. A half-dressed Frances, holding her navy blue dress front together with one hand and gripping a sputtering candle with the other, was calling her name between hoarse cries, a dry, sobbing sound that would not stop.
Hester! Come! Come!
Hester sat bolt upright, alarm drying her mouth and her tongue.
It's William! Amos Fisher just arrived! William's horse fell and he struck his head against a bridge!
Dumbly, Hester voiced, "The horse struck his head?"
No! William!
Frances was screaming now, hoarsely.
Where is he? They brought him back! He's lying in the barn!
Is he alive? There was no answer, only the slamming of the door, the rain on the roof, the sound of footsteps as they splashed through the rain. William's inert form was brought to the house and laid on their bed. His heavy black hair clung to his skull, forming a cap that allowed his ears to show. They were white, bloodless, a sight that seemed alien to Hester. She had hardly ever seen his ears since his hair reached to chin level. Now he was strangely defenseless, even sensitive somehow. Frances moaned and cried, making strange, choppy little sounds of fear and foreboding. Her hands shook as she helped Hester put William into dry clothes, roll him over, and cover him. The doctor would come as soon as the floodwaters receded. Smelling salts brought no response.
Hester worked as the morning light crept into the room, gray, ghost-like, ominous. She glided from the bed to the fire, stroking William's forehead with cloths soaked in vinegar and camphor. She sat by their bed, watching his face for signs of awareness, trying to endure Francis's wet sounds of lip-smacking and crying. Elias and Ben Hertzla came, peering under William's eyelids and pinching his nose to see if he would gasp. The doctor came from Lancaster, held William's hand, and said there was little to do except wait to see how soon he would awaken. His heartbeat was good and strong, his pulse lively. He was a young man and healthy. He would probably be fine after he woke up. The doctor left, and still the rain continued to pound on the roof. Hester was left alone with William. How could she begin to sort out her feelings when so many emotions crashed into her senses, leaving her with no clear direction? Sad, yes, to see her husband, the William she knew so well, lying inert, unable to move. She was surprised by an overwhelming kindness she suddenly felt toward him. He had been so capable, always following his father's pattern of managing the farm. His profile was so handsome, yet still. His dark lashes lay on his white cheeks, his nose perfectly shaped and adding to his good looks. No wonder she had been visually attracted to him. The pinched lines between his eyes and his dark eyebrows gave away his capacity for raw and unseemly fury. The thought of his demise forced its way into her mind. No, he would live. She would be able to bear his children. The farm would prosper. Their children would till the soil, and their children after them. God would smile down on her, bless her yet, in spite of her troublesome ways, her uprising against her husband. William would live. It was necessary that he did. The rain stopped when the northeasterly wind changed to the west. Unbroken gray clouds tore in two on the western horizon, allowing a darker gray, rolling cloud to emerge, followed by churning white ones. Raindrops skittered from the eaves, were blown sideways, and then fell to the ground with a defeated sigh. By the time a brilliant blue sky showed behind the gray clouds, the wind was already teasing the tree branches, ruffling the grasses, swaying the weeds that seemed dead. Hester listened. What she heard was more than the wind. A low roaring swept over the landscape. The wind crashed against the stone walls of the house, seized the window panes and rattled them in its teeth. It lifted loose shingles and let them fall. Floppy gates swung back and forth. Barn doors flapped. Windows shivered as men dashed madly, clutching their hats. Their beards split in two. They pushed rocks against the barn doors, latched windows and half doors. Slowly, the Conestoga Creek went back to its borders, grumbling and leaving a residue of disease in its wake. Horses pulled carriages through the mud. Mud glued to their wooden wheels, making their load twice as heavy. Neighbors hopped down from the buggies, knocking mud from their boots in the brown yard. They brought biscuits and dumplings, stews and soups. So many remedies from kindly, well-meaning faces. Rub a potato and bury it at midnight when the moon is full. He will awaken. Use burdock root for the palsy or for fainting. Old Hannah Troyer, bent and feeble, her teeth gone so long her gums were tough as nails, put a gnarled hand on William's forehead and repeated the Lord's Prayer 5 times in German, the wart at the end of her nose sliding up and down with each word. Hester met each visitor at the door, thanked them for coming, then took her place beside William on the chair by his bed. Francis talked and talked, giving each of the visitors a full report of his fall, about the night they brought him home, what an exceptional, well-behaved son he had always been. Each visitor heard an account of his abstinence, how he never touched hard cider or apple whiskey, and how, unlike his father and brothers, he had never smoked a pipe or chewed tobacco. William was becoming so thin. Hester repeatedly tried to feed him and give him a drink. Still, he slept on. She felt almost crazy at the end of 7 days. So many visitors, so many good wishes. They flowed and swirled about the room like incense, leaving a blessed odor of love and kindness, along with pies and cakes and loaves of bread. Everyone agreed that no one could be blamed. It had simply been an accident. The group of men had been riding. Their horses were lively and well-behaved when they neared the bridge, where the water was churning and roiling only a foot below. But when the henhouse floated down the swollen creek and crashed into the bridge, William's horse lunged to the left, away from the terrifying crash, and unseated William so that he flew through the air. His head hit the side of the bridge. Amos Fisher said reverently that it sounded like a ripe melon when he hit the ground. Phineas Stoltzfus said,
"Ach, du lieber."
They came and cried with Francis, wrung Elias's hand, shook their heads in sorrow at the sight of his beautiful young wife sitting so stony-faced, so unmoving. A good thing she was barren. The little ones need not see their dat like this. Anschaute soch. The brothers-in-law and sisters came, their voices hushed, their footsteps muted as they rocked back and forth, their hands clasped behind their backs, unable to voice the emotion they felt. Johnny would not enter the room, saying it gave him the shivers. Hester knew better. They ate their meals together. The Amish women of the community cooked and did the washing. They spoke of it that the young wife would not cry. Had not cried ever, that anyone could tell. It was the Indian in her. They didn't feel the things white people did. Death was different to Indians. Hannah Troyer's voice rose. The wart on the end of her nose jumped when she spoke emphatically,
"He's not dead yet."
Eliza Burt's eyebrows jumped and said he may as well be. All of this was only a buzz in Hester's ears. Unable to sleep well, afraid he would wake and call her name, she never slept deeply, which finally caused her days to take on a dreamlike quality. She was finding it hard to separate the real from the unreal. When gentle souls clasped her hand in both of theirs and cried great quantities of tears, her face remained serene, calm, dry-eyed. Her large black eyes were rimmed with gray shadows. Her skin was dry from the lack of fresh air and much-needed moisture. Toward the end of the ninth day, after everyone had gone home and Frances had swept the floor, she stood over her son, crying and smacking her lips in the odd way she had. As she bade Hester goodnight with a touch on her shoulder, the door opened and Elias entered alone.
"Go on home, Francis."
He spoke the words with unaccustomed authority. Francis went, without a backward glance. Elias came slowly toward Hester and stopped directly in front of her chair.
"Hester."
She looked up, questioning.
"He won't live, you know."
Hester said nothing.
"Not anymore. Tomorrow is the 10th day."
Hester nodded.
"I came to tell you that in spirit I have stood by you. William is so much like his mother. I don't believe you've always had a good life with my son."
In the light of the fire, a teardrop like silver appeared, trembled, and dropped, creating a glistening rivulet of moisture on one brown cheek.
"God has mysterious ways, but sometimes they are not so mysterious. You will be free to love again, and I believe that is his will. You are a special woman, and I also believe he has plans for you."
He hesitated, then placed a thin hand on her shoulder.
"Hezekiah."
Silence, laden with kindness, whispered its way into the room.
"You will always have a home here. You may always stay if you want to, my daughter."
His presence and kind words were hard to grasp as a great knot of fear and self-condemnation formed in her throat. "But I am not worthy of your blessing. I have not always loved William, nor bowed to his will in the way he required. God is punishing me for rising up against him."
"As I have not always loved my Francis, Hester, you and I have done the best we could. I have full trust that we will someday hear the words, 'Well done, thou good and faithful servant.'"
The silence was unbroken as Elias laid a hand on Hester's shoulder once more, as if the touch could assure her of his words. He offered a solid, warm caress to comfort her and fill her with the same faith he carried deep in his heart, covered only by his humble demeanor. Then, in a broken cry, Hester breathed, "He must live, he must, so I can have a chance to do better." Elias sighed, a ragged sound of pity which grew from his own agony of living out his years with a woman devoid of compassion.
You could do your best, and it would fall short every time.
But God must give me another chance.
Her words were heavy with desperation. For a long moment, Elia stood close to his son, watching the slight rising and falling of his chest. The oil lamp flickered, sputtered, and then resumed its steady glow. The shadows on the whitewashed wall crept after Elias's form as he stepped forward, bending slowly to brush back a lock of William's dark hair. The corners of his mouth twisted as he struggled for control.
I think unser Herrn Jesu understands William. I think he knows his nature. He was born with one much like his mother has. He took Jesus as his savior and tried to follow him, but his exacting nature often got in the way. He did the best he could. I trust God understands this when he reaches the other shore. William loved you, Hester, in his own way.
Why did those words bring her comfort when his previous ones did not? Was she somehow responsible for William's salvation? Thank you, Elias, for your kindness. He nodded once, wished her a good night, and then moved out the door and into the night. It was only then that Hester lost all reserve. The stone in her heart was smashed to tiny fragments as she bent over, pressed down by the weight of her disappointment. It could have been better. Their marriage had fallen so short of her expectations. She had longed to be cherished and loved for who she was, not for who he wanted her to be, as he tried to mold her into a more devoted, strict, and spiritual wife. Sobs tore from her throat, dry, rasping sounds of grief and unfulfillment. She rocked back and forth, her hands covering her face, her eyes closed tightly against the awful battle in her heart. If only he would live, she would tell him all this. She would pour out words of love, help him change, teach him compassion somehow. Oh, somehow she would find a way. As the oil burned low, the smell of the rancid wick stopped Hester's keening. She brought up the corner of her black apron, swabbed her face, and then bent to extinguish the flame, throwing the room into darkness, except for the dying fire in the great fireplace. It was enough. Hester sat back in her chair and turned her face to William. He was but a slight bump in the white bed, his hair etched dark against the pillow.
Why must you go now, William? Why did we ever meet on my father's fateful wedding day? What plan did God see?
Getting up, she placed a hand on his chest and stroked the fabric of his nightshirt, her hand stumbling on the row of buttons. She felt his forehead and his lips, which were dry and parched. Going to the bucket on the dry sink, she poured a small amount of water on a cloth, wrung it into the dishpan, and wiped his mouth lightly. His cheeks were so sunken, so white. She wiped his face all over as if to instill life. She knew that beneath the caked black hair, there was a large, angry bruise that had spread almost the entire way across his skull. She touched it now with her long, delicate brown fingers. Her lips moved in prayer. Turning down the white quilt, she brought his hand, the large, calloused hand that had held her so many times, tenderly to her lips. I love you, William. Her voice was low, whispered, calm. The storm of her grief had prepared her for God's will. Whether he lived or whether he died, he was the Lord's. The window panes let in a small amount of the night sky. Hester moved to the door, lifted the heavy iron latch, and stepped outside, closing it softly behind her. The air was cold. The chill crept up her arms and across her shoulders. She wrapped her arms around her thin waist and lifted her face to find the familiar constellations. A sliver of a moon hung low in the sky, the remainder of it like a veil trying to appear invisible. But it was there. Unbelievably, she heard Kate's low laugh. You know, Hester, the moon thinks it's clever, showing us only portions of itself, but we know it's there, she had said. Tears of longing rained down Hester's face. She wished to bury her face in Kate's old blue dress, her shoulder warm and soft and forgiving, to feel her soft hands pat her back, her voice crooning, making a terrible world into a perfectly beautiful one.
The shrill cry of spring peepers came up from the creek. It was the seasonal ritual, this beckoning of spring, along with a call for purple violets and yellow, round-faced dandelions. Turning, Hester lifted the latch to go inside. She hesitated at the high-pitched warble of the screech owl. Another one replied, a melodious sound of two of God's creatures. She slept fitfully, too exhausted to stay awake, or to sleep soundly. Just before morning, when the clock's hands on the mantel crept toward 5, William breathed his last. Hester didn't know. She had fallen asleep for only an instant. She woke with a start, went to William, and felt the difference immediately. There was no movement. The rising and falling of his chest had stopped. His face was slack, gray. Quite simply, Hester did not know what to do. The tears that should have come, the grief she should have felt, were replaced by a familiar shroud of indifference, a separation from reality. When Frances pushed her way in, her eyes wide with fear, her face white beneath the black kerchief on her head, she stopped at Hester's chair, a question in her eyes, her mouth working. Hester looked up. "He's gone." Frances nodded and went to William's bed. The familiar sighs and sobs of grief, the wet smacking of her lips began all over again. She keened, lifting her face, then fell on her knees, her cries reaching levels of hysteria. Hester stood, helped her up, and patted her shoulder clumsily. She spoke words of encouragement, but nothing could stop the rushing torrent of Frances's sorrow. A mother's grief, Hester reasoned, is a desperate hurt, the tearing away of a child before his time. And so she comforted, answered questions, shouldered accusations. Yes, she should have stayed awake. She should have, certainly. But the curtain of death was drawn, and Frances could find no way to push it back. Chapter 16. Covered completely in black, her hat pulled well over the sides of her face, Hester stood alone by the casket. It was a plain wooden box where her husband lay, waiting to be lowered into the wet soil of Lancaster County, in the graveyard where mounds of fresh earth were heaped over the graves of the children who had not survived the winter. The sing-song voice of the minister reading the light failed to bring any response from the grieving widow, while Frances blew her nose copiously behind her. Elias bowed his head, wept quietly but remained calm, his face a harbor of peace. The horses and carriages tied along the fence were in a neat row, the group of mourners all in black. The trees had not yet begun to push their buds, their branches stark and black as well. The grass was olive green, mingled with the dead brown of winter, bent over, waiting to be pushed out of existence by fresh, lively new shoots. After the Lord's Prayer, Hester stayed by the grave as Frances and Elias turned to go. She felt a tap on her shoulder. Hester turned.
"You can ride back with me."
It was Johnny, the brother-in-law, without Naomi, his wife. "No." Without another word, he turned away, a deep crimson spreading across his face, his eyes blinking with humiliation at the low-lying fury in her one word of refusal. The funeral dinner had been prepared by members of the Amish community. Long tables were set in William and Hester's house, then filled with great platters of sliced beef, mashed potatoes and gravy, along with cheese and applesauce. Hester sat humbly with Elias and Frances, William's brothers and sisters, and the family's large, rowdy group of children. She spoke when she was spoken to, and acknowledged well-wishers, but nothing seemed real. She did not want to be noticed. She wished they'd all go away and leave her alone. Yet she did not want to be alone with her thoughts this first evening, with William's passing so close. It seemed as if he should be sitting there by her side, laughing, always glad to be among his brethren. She was so weary, so bone-tired, and yet she still needed to spend the remainder of the day with William's family, the dreaded Johnny among them. She sighed a small breath of defeat. She was seated on a bench beside the fire, William's sister Amanda holding her infant daughter beside her, surrounded by children, aunts, and cousins. She didn't notice her at first. It was only when a narrow black form sat on the bench beside her and a hand reached over to clasp her brown one firmly in her own that she turned her head to see two bright brown eyes, like polished stones, peer up at her like an inquisitive sparrow. Hester. The word was spoken solidly, well-placed, like bricks, square and useful and sensible. The voice was low, accompanied by a dip of heavy eyelids held there, shutting away curiosity, as if she wanted to share a moment of silence, of companionship. Then the eyelids bounced back and the curiosity resumed, brighter than ever.
I am Puppy Kinnish.
Hester smiled, a slow, hesitant widening of her perfect lips.
Barbara King, in English. Every old maid in Lancaster County is called Puppy. Don't ask me why.
She chuckled and quickly covered her mouth with her hand, clenched tightly around her chin as if to squelch any humor or unseemly words.
You are Hester, the wife of my second cousin William. We have never met, likely because I have been teaching school in Tulpehocken Valley, about 25 miles away as the crow flies. As the crow doesn't fly, it's a long, arduous trip, hard on the backside.
Hester wasn't sure if she had heard correctly, so she didn't say anything.
So, Hester, what are your plans?
Hester shrugged her shoulders, a gesture revealing the blankness she felt, the complete absence of anything called a plan.
You don't have any, right?
Hester shook her head.
I didn't think so.
Buppy leaned back to allow a large uncle to pass. Her eyebrows were lowered in annoyance, but only for a short time.
You don't want to stay in this stone house by yourself.
It was a statement, not a question, and not a gentle inquiry either. I guess not. Another statement. No, I don't plan on it, but I hardly know where else to go. Hester spoke so softly, Buppy had to lower her head to hear her. Buppy's head swiveled in both directions as if she were waiting for a passing team or a pedestrian, the way Emma Ferry did in town. Then she lowered her head.
You don't have family, do you?
In Berks County.
Not Amish.
Yes, they are Amish. Hans and Annie Suk. Buppy's mouth dropped open.
You're?
Clearly speechless now, she drew back, her eyes wide open, her small mouth open in disbelief.
You're that Indian baby.
Yes, I guess so.
Oh, sis unverständig.
Again, Buppy clapped a hand over her mouth and closed her eyes to stares of disapproval. When the coast was clear, she launched into a loudly whispered account of everything she had heard about Hester over the years. She knew Annie all right, couldn't stand her, mean as a wasp. No apologies were offered after each blunt statement, so Hester took it the way Buppy said it, as an honest opinion that didn't bother to be clothed in masks of righteousness or pride.
Well, here's my offer. I don't want to teach another year. Those people in Tulpehocken Valley are about the limit. I'm tired of their gumma. So would you want me to live here with you? I have my own place, but it's small.
Hester rolled awkwardly into a pit of despair. She searched for words, her eyes large and frightened. Buppy saw immediately the need to reserve her proposition and said so quickly, grabbing both of Hester's hands and holding them warmly in her own, as her brown eyes filled with quick, glistening tears of sympathy.
Ah, Hester, I'm not fit. No wonder I don't have a husband. Forget what I said. You barely know who I am.
Quickly, Hester grabbed back Buppy's hands and hung on as if they were a branch in floodwaters. No, oh no, let's just... Buppy, please come visit me on Sunday. I have no one and no place to go. Elias, father, wants me to stay, but Francis... Her voice faded away.
Francis, she's a regular scarecrow, meaner too.
Hester smiled and lifted her own hand to cover her mouth as Buppy clapped a hand to her chin again. The eyes above the hand sparkled and danced mischievously, rolled in Francis's direction, then closed as she laughed quietly.
I'll be back Sunday.
With that, Buppy got up and made her way quickly through the room, stopping to talk to a few relatives before heading out the door. Hester held babies, talked to the bashful children, and listened to Francis's account of William's accident and his life with Hester. She acknowledged kind words of sympathy, shaking hands with so many people they seemed to be an endless line of faces and figures dressed in black. Her head spun with weariness. She longed to lie down anywhere. She seriously thought of sitting against a wall somewhere, wherever she could close her eyes, but knew she could not until the last well-wisher had gone through that door. The night did come, as it always does, but never was the veil of darkness more anticipated. She refused every offer from kind folks who wanted to stay the night, saying she would be safe here with Elias and Francis. She fell into bed and remembered drawing the quilt over her shoulders before falling into a deep and restful sleep, the sound of the tree frogs and barking foxes going undetected. The bedroom was pitch dark when Hester opened her eyes. The soft sighing of a spring rain against the window panes reminded her of William's passing, a gray mourning that filled her heart, dripping from the battered portion that remained. She had never imagined the despair his death would bring, the solid weight of guilt mixed with disappointment, the life-draining inadequacy of her spirit. If only she had done better. She had been unfit to be the helpmeet she had promised to be on the day she spoke her sacred vows. God had not blessed their union with children, heirs to William's family, and it was her fault. Yes, he had been harsh at times, but that was his right. He was the husband, she the lesser vessel, and she had never succumbed fully to his will. Now she must live with the punishment God had wrought. He had taken William, and that too was her fault. Wave after wave of humiliation accompanied the falling rain that blew softly against the dark window panes, until the thought of William became a torment. She must never think of marrying again. In her wildest imagining, she had not thought of marriage as the burden it had become, unable to bow fully to the will of her husband and his family. She had spoken out boldly, accusing him of his lack of love, when all the while it had been her own stubborn will refusing to bend. It was the way the Indians in this Pennsylvania forest refused to bend to the demands of the white man who hacked down their sacred trees, who bought and owned the land they assumed belonged to the creator they worshipped. She would never be a white woman. Somehow, before Barbara King came back to visit, she must leave. She would find her way to the western frontier, to her people. She would speak to Elias and Francis. Perhaps they would understand her sorrow. The gray light of dawn brought fresh resolve. This time, she would ask for a horse. She would plan better now that she was aware of the dangers, the thirst, the hunger that had been her constant companion when she left Hans and Annie's homestead. She had one wish, to see Emma and Billy Ferry. She had never thanked them properly or enough for what they had done. She was surprised to find herself weak, her joints aching, her head spinning dizzily as she got out of bed, found her clothes and stoked the fire. Her hands shook as she swung the kettle over the new flames. The room tilted as she brought the cold water to her face at the dry sink. She was bringing the steel-toothed comb through her heavy black hair when the latch was lifted with a resounding crack of steel, the door creaked open, and Francis stood in the gray, early morning light.
You're up.
Yes.
Have you eaten?
No.
Then come eat breakfast with Elias and me. Johnny and Naomi have spent the night. It would be nice if you ate with us.
Hester kept her back turned, her shaking hands twisting her hair into a bun on the back of her head.
Well?
All right. I will come. There was no reply, only the creaking of the door and the latch falling into place behind Francis. Hester finished inserting the steel hairpins. She reached for the white muslin cap, placed it on her head, and tied the heavy strings under her chin. She made her bed, tucking the white quilt beneath the pillows, stroked the top to smooth out the creases, then turned to the corner for the bellows. She clapped them up and down to fan the small flames licking out below the chunk of wood she had placed on the dying embers. She swept the hearth and carefully replaced the chairs. She would clean the house properly after the men had moved the wooden benches to the attic, where it was customary to store them until the next church service. The act of carrying out normal, mundane chores was healing and allowed her a sense of well-being, if only in sparse amounts. She threw a thin black shawl over her shoulders and stepped out into the fine, misty rain, then made her way to the addition built onto her own stone farmhouse, hesitating at the door. She dreaded the breakfast table with Johnny's mocking eyes. Taking a deep breath, she knocked lightly, then pushed up the heavy latch to find the family seated around the table, candles on the mantelshelf illuminating the room, the smell of bacon and fried cornmeal mush hovering thickly around the room.
Frances cleared her throat. We have been waiting.
I'm sorry. Quickly, Hester shrugged out of her shawl and slid quietly into a chair, her hands clasped in her lap, her eyes downcast. All heads bowed instantly in silent prayer. Then Elias lifted his head, cleared his throat, and looked around the table.
Everyone help yourselves now.
How could Hester know her own stark, tragic beauty in the flickering yellow light of the candles? If anything, the experience of sadness only enhanced the dark luster of her large almond-shaped eyes, the thick black lashes drooping in remembered sorrows. She bowed her long, slender neck in humility, her mouth vulnerable with the sense of past mistakes, a sight that left Johnny's eyes glued to her as he tried unsuccessfully to tear them away. Naomi, a small wren of a woman, bright-eyed and quick in her movements, helped the four children with their breakfasts, cutting slabs of fried mush, tying a bib around the one-year-old, completely oblivious to her husband's wandering.
You have slept well? Elias asked, his eyes kind.
Yes.
That's good. I was afraid you wouldn't sleep after everything was over.
Frances blinked once, twice. She opened her mouth as if to speak, hesitated, then closed it. She took up her spoon, toying with her bacon. Suddenly she spoke, her words cutting through the kind words of her husband.
I told you, Elias, death is different to the Indians. They do not feel loss the way we do, neither do they treasure life.
Naomi looked up, her bird-like eyes darting from one face to another. Hester's heart leaped within her. She recognized the opportunity to present her case. It took all of her courage, but she folded her hands on her lap, lifted her head, and began. Yes, Frances, you are right. I am an Indian. I have failed you in many ways, as I have failed William. Elias raised his hand to silence her.
Frances drew in a sharp breath, then laid down her spoon, poised to hear.
If you will be kind enough to give me one good horse, I will leave today. I will ride away from Lancaster County to find my people. I am not fit to be an Amish wife and mother.
Frances hissed. You can't!
Why not? Hester was calm and composed, drawing strength from her own words.
How would that make us appear in the eyes of the Amish community? Our son's wife, riding off to join those heathen Indians! We would be the ones who failed then. They would excommunicate you!
Shrieking now, her voice high-pitched in desperation, her head bobbing in agitation, Frances was clearly horrified. Elias sat as a stone, unmovable.
Johnny snickered self-consciously.
Naomi broke out.
Hester, why do you say that? You have been a good wife. By all appearances, you have been an excellent housekeeper and a learned quilter. William seemed happier than I have ever seen him.
Elias began nodding his head in approval.
I told Hester she can always stay here. She's now the heir to the farm, rightfully. She is William's wife.
Still!
Frances's command slashed across the table. The children sat up and stopped chewing, their eyes wide with interest.
I don't know why you would say such a thing. Elias, how can Hester own this farm? An Indian! I certainly hope you have not gone to see a lawyer unbeknownst to me.
It is the law, Frances. The wife inherits the husband's share.
William had nothing!
Frances spat. Hester listened. She could think of nothing she wanted less than this farm or the great cold stone house that held William's austerity. His rules clung to the whitewashed walls. The shadow of his superiority stained the wooden beams of the ceiling. The wide oak floorboards sounded the echoes of his displeased footsteps. The marriage bed spoke of her inability to conceive. Every corner of the house was rife with the ghosts of her shortcomings. I don't want the farm. Soft and low, Hester stated the fact.
Johnny's eyes pierced her face.
Naomi saw the look of her husband.
I'll take it,
he said quickly. Elias looked to the eager, flushed face of his son. Frances trembled. Then a slow smile spread across her face, the pleasure erasing the anxiety.
Why, of course, the most perfect solution. God be praised.
Seeing the happiness on their grandmother's face, the children smiled and resumed eating, content. Elias blew on his pewter mug of tea. For a long while he said nothing. He looked first at Naomi, whose eyes were bright with anticipation, then bowed his head to the turn of circumstances he knew were out of his control.
It is done, then.
Those words sealed the ownership of the farm.
Triumphant, Johnny's eyes seared into Hester's, conveying victory over her. She lowered her eyes. Otherwise, the contempt would have flashed, and Naomi would have seen. Best to let her revel in her husband's acquisition.
Although I cannot allow you to have a horse, it is simply not safe for you to travel on your own with robbers and highwaymen about as thick as fleas. Johnny and I will build a cabin for you here on the home place. You can be mowed to Naomi. We will pay your living expenses.
Hester shook her head before Elias stopped speaking. No. Frances breathed out. So obvious was her relief. With shaking hands, she lifted her tea and sipped a tiny portion, blinking rapidly.
Where will you go?
Johnny's eyes begged her to stay. She was a necessity for him, like she had been for Hans. Barbara King is coming to make me an offer, but I would rather travel to Ohio, to go back to my people where I belong.
Elias shook his head, his mouth grim.
Hester, you are one of us. You do not belong with the Indians. They are being steadily pushed farther west, becoming more savage and more hostile as time goes on. Or so we hear. You have been raised among the Amish. You have promised to keep the faith. How could you turn your back to us now?
Stony-faced, Hester lifted her eyes. It would be out of necessity that I do this. They allowed her the good little mare Fanny and the top buggy that day. She had only one wish, and that was to visit Emma Ferry, which they agreed to. Hester's face was flushed with anticipation as she took up the reins, clucked to the little mare, and rode away from the farm in the gray mist of a spring rain. The wheels turned, picking up mud and old withered leaves of winter. Fanny's hooves made a sucking sound in the low, wet places, but Hester saw neither the mud nor the gray drizzle. On this one day, she was doing something she had wanted to do for years, return to Emma and Billy. The surrounding fields were still unplowed. Old, wet cornstalks bent low, driven into the earth by the heavy snows of winter. The hayfields were drab, but new growth was sprouting in low places, the promise of an abundance of grass to cut into hay. An oncoming team of horses made her pull on the right rein, drawing Fanny to the side, allowing the team to pass. Inquisitive faces peered out from the open front of the buggy. Hester nodded, glad when they continued on their way. On the outskirts of town, the road widened and hardened. The stones from the lime quarry made traveling easier. Fanny pricked up her ears as they passed the blacksmith shop on the right, a low stone building with a wide chimney. Smoke poured from it, created by the hot coals used by the smithy. She remembered her excursions with Hans, the smell of the horse's hooves as his trimming knife cut expertly into them. His strong, muscular arms pounded the shoes into shape. There was the anvil, the hot coals, the odor of hay and corn and manure. From her perch on the wagon, she would take in all of this, cultivating a love of horses that Hans had taken away when he forbade her to ride. Still, it was an enriching part of her childhood, listening to Hans's voice as he told her stories, bouncing along in the seat of the spring wagon beside him. He had been a good father to her. Many carriages passed her now. There were poor farmers and clumsy wagons with wide wheels covered in mud. Drawn by thin mules, their ribs strained against the wet brown coat covering them. Their necks were too thin, their heads enormous and bobbing, unsightly ears above them. There were also ornate hacks, polished to a high gloss and drawn by high-stepping black horses, their coats gleaming in the rain. Their drivers were top-hatted and mustached, with long, thick sideburns down their cheeks like squirrels' tails. Ladies protected themselves from the rain with fancy parasols as they cast superior glances at the Amish woman clad entirely in black, her plain, serviceable buggy drawn by the squat little mare. A group of children dashed across the road, their hats and bonnets slick with the rain, the girls' skirts like striped flowers, the petticoats beneath them ruffled and sewn by loving mothers. The lone boy strolled through the rain, rolling a hoop expertly, his white shirt front in stark relief against the gray of his open coat. For one instant, Hester thought it must be Billy. Then remembered that Billy would be 15 years old now, close to 16, and no longer a child. She drove up the narrow passageway called Water Street, turned left on Orange, and then right onto Mulberry. Everywhere she looked, there was a construction site. Houses were springing up like mushrooms. The homes were all made of wood. Even the chimneys were slapped together with mud, the way Hans disliked. He said more houses burned to the ground because of shoddy chimneys than for any other reason. Hester knew the wealthy lot owners erected these wood dwellings cheaply, charged a goodly sum for rent, and made a hefty profit. It was only when yet another fire broke out that they saw the error of their ways. She drew Fanny off to the right and tied her to a lamppost when she neared Emma Ferry's house. Better to walk the last distance, then knock on the door to see if she was home. Her breath came rapidly as she blanketed the steaming Fanny. She patted her forehead, promised her return, and walked across the street, a lone black figure, the corners of her shawl spreading out behind her. There it was, the sturdy house made of stone and wood, the steps going up right off the street as if to welcome any person who wanted to enter. Hester drew in a deep breath, steadied herself, and lifted a hand to knock. She tried once, then twice. Disappointed, she raised her hand again and knocked harder. When no one answered, she drew back to gaze through the window. On a day such as this, Emma would be burning her oil lamp and perhaps a few candles. Obviously, there was no one home. She turned to make her way back down the steps when she thought of Walter Trout. It would be better to see him than no one at all. She made her way to his front door, resolutely, remembering his kindness, his effusive words of praise. Seeing him was the closest thing to meeting Emma Ferry, and it would have to do for today. Chapter 17. She knocked with a firm rap on the front door, followed by another. She stepped back when the latch jostled, lifted, and the door swung slowly inward. Hester's mouth dropped open when a ruffled white house cap appeared around the edge of the door, below which shone two beady blue eyes and a florid pink face. Emma Ferry opened her mouth to speak, closed it again, gave up, and threw both hands in the air, her eyes wide and full of recognition.
Ach, mein Gott im Himmel!
Hester started to laugh, but a sob cut it in two. She fell into Emma's soft, plump arms, bending over to lay her bonneted head on her warm shoulder and to let her tears and hiccuping flow for a long moment. Emma's plump hands patted and soothed, her voice crooning as if Hester were an infant. Somehow, Hester was drawn into the dim hallway. The door was closed behind her, and she was enveloped in warmth and the heavenly scent of ginger and molasses and cinnamon and sugar.
Ach, du je, meine Hester, meine own Hester. How often my prayers went to heaven because of you, meine Liebchen, meine Indian girl, still so beautiful.
Exclaiming nonstop, Emma reached for Hester's hat strings, yanked on them, and removed the hat. Her brilliant gaze swept over the white cap, taking in the severe cut of her black dress, cape, and apron.
You really are Amish, she said forcefully.
The back door swung open. The gray light from the doorway was darkened as Walter Trout hove his large frame through it.
Emma?
He shouted. Emma held up one finger.
Yes, Walter?
Where are you?
Here in the hallway. Come, look who's here. Come quick.
Walter Trout filled up the width of the hallway with his presence. His reaction much the same as Emma's. He began with a polite handshake, but pulled Hester into a gentlemanly embrace with one arm, looking down on her face, and proclaimed her his long-lost daughter. Hester let herself absorb the luxury of their welcome, the love that flowed unhampered by pride or judgment. Her soul expanded with the knowledge that so much kindness was available, and that God had not forgotten her after all.
Walter's shirt smelled of ginger and cinnamon, his breath like sugar.
She found herself seated at the kitchen table, a checked cloth covering it. Walter arranged cookies on a platter, Emma put the tea kettle on the stove and brought out china cups, talking all the while.
Tell us, please tell us, Hester. How is your life? Does he treat you well? Are you happy?